Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. Thank you for stopping by and tuning in to our program. We are here on Thursdays and Sundays, recording internet talk radio about all the things that we consider to be interesting and of importance. And we hope that this can help you to broaden your horizon and expand your perspective. Our website is redicecreations.com. That's R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. You can go there for much more radio, video interviews, webcasts, films, news. And if you want to have more, you can always become a member on our website and get full access to all the material that we have to offer for you on our website. And today we are joined by author, psychologist, and tarot expert Art Rosengarten, or Dr. Arthur Rosengarten. If you tuned in last Thursday, you heard our program with Lon Milo Duquette. And just like Lon, Art is also featured in the DVD series that we talked about with Lon about, The Great Work, it's called. It's produced by Chance Gardner and Venisi McNeil, who was behind the DVD Magical Egypt, that underground classic, if you will. A really nice production, just as The Great Work is. We're going to talk about that later on in the program as well. But Art is the author of Tarot and Psychology, Spectrums of Possibility. He's been teaching the tarot for 20 years, and he wrote the first accredited doctoral dissertation on tarot back in 1985 at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. And today we are primarily going to talk about the tarot and psychology. Art also has a new deck and guidebook coming out later this year, in the summer, I think, called Rosengarten's Tarot of the Nine Paths. We're going to talk about that as well. The website that you can take a look at right away is simply artrosengarten.com. We will have this linked up, of course, on redicecreations.com, so you can find it easy from there. He's also behind Tarot Psych, an international site for psychologically based tarot practitioners, therapists, readers, healers, and the like, who are interested in group cyber experiments with the tarot and other divinatory tools. So if you're interested in finding out more about that, you can go to geocities.com/tarot psych, as in psychology. I've just removed the ology at the end there. So it's geocities.com/tarot psych. So with that, welcome to Red Eyes Radio, Art. Very nice of you to come on our program and spend some of your time with us here today.
Well, it's wonderful to be here with you.
We're very glad to have you, and I want to begin ask you a little bit about, I guess, when you started to weave these two different disciplines of the psychology and the tarot together. It seems to be, on the surface at least, that this is kind of a weird mix, but as far as I understand both of these disciplines, they actually are not that different. Tell us about this, Art.
Well, yes, it is unusual, but when you think about it, tarot cards and, let's say, dreams and other interesting parts of the unconscious psychologically are very related. They're symbols that come out of the depths of the human mind. And if, as a Jungian-based psychologist in graduate school, studying dream work and depth psychology and things like that, it occurred to me that the tarot card images were almost like waking dreams, and they had a lot of advantages in that they were much more accessible. And in fact, they invited a very interesting process called divination, where you randomly select these dreamlike images and opened up the field for a synchronistic event to occur, which is a tarot reading. And so that became very intriguing to me, and I ended up studying that in graduate school and writing my dissertation on comparing dream work with tarot readings and psychological projective tests like the Rorschach ink blots and the TAT, which are also these visual pictures that are kind of intriguing and stimulate a lot of psychological content, and then seeing how what goes on in a I guess in a psychological testing environment where a person is given these pictures and asked to respond to them, seeing how the tarot cards actually might be a similar sort of stimulus. And that has led me down this long and interesting path with the tarot.
Would you say that it's primarily through the work of Jung and his work in alchemy that got you into the tarot, also, or was this in a reverse, if you know what I mean?
No, it was Jung first. Certainly I was a great student of Jungian psychology before I even got to graduate school. I've been through my own analysis and had read quite a bit of Jung, but also my own academic interest at that time, and I guess spiritual interest, was more Eastern, in Buddhist Zen practice. And so in the Eastern mind, there is a very easy step into divination and synchronicity. It's kind of a natural, and symbols, by the way. So it was combined Jung on the West and really more Buddhism on the East, both, I guess, kind of fertilized this interest in this tool that opened up present moment awareness, which is like Zen, through symbols and the unconscious. So yes, it was a bit of both.
Interesting. And I mean, tell us a little bit about this interest in regards to dreams. I guess this is a big piece of the puzzle, at least for me as well, and it seems to be even for psychologists, that they as Jung, for instance, who looked at dreams as a kind of a significant, I guess, message from the unconscious, right?
Yes. Well, dreams are stories in symbol form that occur spontaneously when we're asleep. But if you got underneath the basic structure of what they may be saying in a given dream, they are usually talking about what the psyche needs to correct itself, or what the person needs to find some compensation or balance to the conscious standpoint. So they're correctives. They're these things that happen kind of naturally, and that all implies, I think, a certain kind of natural intelligence that's really underneath the ego center that is operating as a kind of a balancer of consciousness. So dreams are fascinating. The problem with dreams is that they're inconsistent, even though everyone dreams all the time at night. Some people have better dream recall, and the retelling of a dream tends to get distorted because they're so easy to forget.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
But the tarot, while it's not as pure and direct as a dream coming from the deep unconscious, the tarot symbols really carry that same kind of world, that unconscious psychical dimension of what I call the intermediate territory. Not ordinary reality, certainly, and it's not enlightenment or some kind of pure being, but it's this imaginal realm that both dreams and the tarot card seem to share.
Interesting.
The last thing on that is that tarot cards have an advantage over dreams in that we can, in the right conditions, just begin to open up a dream or a reading, a tarot reading, and do it in a much more controlled way. And we can sort of freeze frame these symbols in a tarot reading where we can sit there and meditate on them or just relate to them in a way that pure dreams are almost impossible to do.
So would you say that in regards to dreams, does a dream need to be decoded or kind of interpreted? And when we do that, we might actually lose the message that we're being given?
Yes. And I'm not into a heavy-handed decoding and getting too rational about working with either dreams That's been a mistake, even in Jungian psychology, with amplification, I think, where it, you know, there's been this direction of now discussing in the light of day in a very intellectual way the symbolism, the story, the, you know, the whole dream world in a way that can deaden actually the true mythic level that the dream really operates on. So there's a skillful way of talking about symbols, bringing them into the moment, engaging with them without killing them with over analysis.
Mm.
That's the key.
Mm. Have you studied anything in regards to the origins of the tarot and where it came from at all?
Well, yeah, but though I don't consider myself a tarot historian like a number of folks that I know, but the thing about tarot origins is very mysterious. No one to date really knows the origin of tarot. We know the first known decks surfaced in the late 14th century in Italy, probably. We have our earliest decks, I think go back to about 1420.
Mm-hmm.
But who the first designer of the tarot is an open question and a controversy in the tarot world. Myself, my way of dealing with that is, it doesn't really matter, because the ultimate designer of the tarot is probably the same vehicle as that which is the ultimate designer of dreams or of the deep imagination. It's coming out of, you might say, the human soul. There may have been a vehicle or an artist or a teacher or someone who channeled that, but it's the deepest levels of it, I think, are innate to the human mind itself and are timeless in that regard.
Mm. And so I know that you, we can talk about this here a little bit later, done your own tarot, of course, based on the number 9, I guess. But generally, before you did this and worked with it, how did you work with it? Did you do readings with tarot, or did you use it primarily for personal studies, or how did you work with it?
Well, absolutely, all of that. You know, I've been a tarot reader for over 30 years, and then as a reader and as a licensed therapist in California, I started to introduce very carefully and sparsely tarot cards into a therapeutic context with clients, sometimes in group therapy, sometimes with patients who were really open to that sort of thing. Not everybody, certainly, and
there
are some people who are very threatened by tarot because tarot has such a strange kind of history and reputation.
Right.
But the thing that I started working with and really went into the creation of my deck, TNP, or Tarot of the Nine Paths, is a technique that's called sand play. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Tell us about that.
Sand play.
I haven't heard about it. Tell us about it.
Okay. Well, it's a really wonderful technique, actually, developed by a Swiss analyst under the tutelage of Carl Jung, named Dora Kalf. I guess this was in the 50s or 40s. And sand play therapy is really quite interesting. It's an international therapeutic movement now. And the way it works is this. In the therapist's office, there is a small sandbox about 8 inches deep, and maybe 3 feet across, painted blue on the bottom and on the sides. And next to the sandbox, there is book subjects, hundreds, if not thousands, of things that you would think are like collectibles, little figurines of virtually every shape and form. And the objects, now I have hundreds and hundreds of them in my travels of collecting little things from people, animals, symbols, ordinary objects to very profound things. In fact, in a sand play collection that the sand play therapists developed, they're all kind of unique. The symbols that are there and on these bookshelves are supposed to symbolically represent everything in the world, everything that has been, and everything that can be. So that kind of includes, it's a big spectrum of stuff, of things. Now, these are little miniatures. So what you do in this process called sand play therapy, particularly in the Jungian sense, is you guide a person or facilitate a person to stand in front of the sandbox and then go to the shelves and then spontaneously create a scene in the box. They can move the sand, they can pour water in it. In the film, The Great Work, that you alluded to earlier, that I'm in and with a number of people, a lot of the scenes took place actually in my office in the sandbox.
Yes.
My office, where you saw a lot of the really interesting symbols, and the filmmakers did a really good job of showing how this process comes alive.
Yes.
Now, I'm talking about sand play only to tell you that my deck of tarot, it was all built on sand play scenes that were digitally photographed and then layered and worked with to create a very unique and, I think, engaging kind of tarot card that's never been done before.
Hmm. Very interesting. And in regards to the sandbox, is that like a symbol for the world or the internal, like the mind, I guess? And in one sense, does the client or the patient in this case get to pick and choose by the figurines? And is it, as you see it, then a message in how they place the figures, where they do it, and in relation to each other, and what they choose? Is that right?
Exactly right. So, you know, the way the process should work is the facilitator does nothing but open up the space and invite the client to, with this simple instruction, make a scene in the box. And then it's wherever the person is drawn, he uses many figures, maybe 20 or 30 of these images, or maybe one or two, and the therapist patiently allows the client to just trust their own intuitive, instinctive nature. They can pour water on the sand, like I said, and they can kind of move it, and then they can go back and forth until they've created something. And it's better, you know, I encourage a client to just trust their feelings here and not to really think it out or try and make something, you know, intentionally. So it usually takes about maybe 10 minutes only.
Mm-hmm.
Person creates this kind of dreamscape, if you will, and then sits down in front of it, and I will diagram it, and then I will, without interpreting it, you know, there's some people that get into this heavy-handed interpretation where they degrade the symbol by reducing it into this means that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem. What the Jungian way of working with symbols is a bit different than the Freudian.
Yes.
In that we don't want to degrade it and ultimately turn it into a thing that has a limited meaning, but rather we want to open it up and see how it and with a feel on a feeling basis how it just resonates with the creator's. So I will just have, you know, the creator of a particular scene talk about what they've created in as few or they're comfortable with, and I may ask them a question about, over here in this left-hand corner where you have whatever, you have a gorilla and three little gypsies and a bicycle and, a soldier. Can you say something about that? What brought you to do that?
Mm-hmm.
And the person will free associate again. At the end of the process, what invariably occurs is that a person's inner self has been projected into the box, and they've opened up a new direct connection with their own psyche in a way that is very satisfying and very spiritual. And then they just leave it, and they, we try not to reduce the meaning, but they take it, and it's a way of getting more deeply in touch with your inner self, you could say.
Would you say that it's an important thing to kind of externalize the internal?
Yes. Well, it's a good question. At times, it is a valuable thing to do. At other times, possibly not. But particularly when a person is going through an intense period in their lives, perhaps, maybe a very creative and interesting period with many projects, and they're pretty much have overwhelmed their conscious ego, and there's a lot of things going on. Just talking about it can only go so far. A person kind of hears themselves think and speak, and the therapist or the receiver can actually take it in directions where it doesn't really want to go.
Hmm.
So under those circumstances, going into a tarot reading, a divination, or doing a santre or sample therapy is a way to continue to open up all of that richness without degrading it into a this means that or some kind of everyday analytical discussion, which actually shuts off the experience.
Hmm.
So that's the realm that my work really takes place in this material.
Interesting. So it's more, I guess what you're saying is that it's more about being a mirror than kind of overanalyzing and putting too much into it for the client, right?
Absolutely correct.
Hmm.
It's the metaphor of water is a good metaphor. When water is still, it becomes like a mirror. But it also, when it's flowing, it goes to the deepest depths on its own accord. It has its own flow. And so it's like water, that psyche. And, why do we do this? I think that in the service of getting more deeply inside with our spiritual nature, or the quiet part inside of us that's very rich and amazing, these methods, they're like oracles. They help you kind of focus inwardly.
You mentioned before also for people that are very kind of involved in many projects, or they're very creative, and in one sense, when they're almost over... when they're flooded in a way with the, just there's too much going on at the same time and they can't get it out, do you think that a process like this would help to keep that flow instead of like shutting down to it, or when it becomes like a bottleneck, it becomes too much to actually shut down?
That's exactly right.
Hmm.
And it's the word is contain, and the process becomes a container for that part of the person, and the therapist takes on that role as a container also, to where when a person who is going through a very dynamic and, like I think most of us are today, stressful and lots of stuff going on, they come into this process where there's a work that's already been opened, and but it's contained, and they kind of step back into it, and the guide or the therapist or the reader honors the boundaries of this special realm and tries to stay out of it and let the person have their own experience with themselves in a way and help them contain that so they can, you know, put a lid on it in a way and go back into the reality level of their ordinary lives and come back to it because it's contained and it's a, you know, it's a special dimension that a person is hard pressed to find in other avenues of their lives.
Mm. What about if someone picks a lot of gods or goddesses from various cultures? Is there in any regard a way that you can kind of I guess them primarily for your own point of view, interpret this as a certain set of archetypes are trying to kind of reach out through the person, or is that wrong to say that? What do you think?
No. It's a very interesting question. Of course, the gods and goddesses are activated and stimulated in this kind of work, but you know, that's a very personal experience, and it's a very, you know, it's a very personal lived spiritual experience that people have in terms of who these archetypes are for them, whether they take on, you know, a traditional religious background, or they're pagan, or they have their own unique relationship to the divine or the sacred. And I think it's important that people have an opportunity to, you know, to do their own unique personal relationship to these things without some authority personage telling them what they are and what they should think about them.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, I think that's largely a problem of organized religion today, from my perspective, is that it kind of shut off the stream of true religious experience or spiritual experience. That's a more spontaneous, natural process that occurs inside people's experience.
Do you think the main problem is this idea of monotheism, that we only have one God in that sense to choose from, one property, and a certain type of property? If we talk about you know, Yahweh or whoever, basically, but there's not room for other types of properties to come through anymore. That has, in some certain sense to me at least, has been lost if we look at the myriad of the gods that existed in the more pagan, religions from before.
Well, yes, of course there's that. You know, I don't think it's you know, the real level that this stuff operates on is underneath that argument of whether it's one or many, and it doesn't really have to be viewed as a problem. You know, the problem of monotheism, say, which obviously has problems, and I'm sure there's problems in the polytheism as well.
Sure.
Depending on what level you come into working with this in your life, so I don't know that it. I don't really think it's important to kind of witch hunt, if you will,
sure,
for the cause or the problem, because that can be itself another problem.
That's right.
You see it, and certainly it can be acknowledged that, yeah, the monotheism, you know, the Western monotheisms have replaced some of the older religions. But then there's, you know, there's a level where it's all non-theism. There's no real deity operating. The deity is kind of a relative level, and then there's the unconditioned mind, which I think is underneath all the theisms, and that's ultimately the goal that I think we all really have, whether we recognize it or not, is to get under the under that belt of theism and get into just the unconditioned, pure being that's underneath everything.
Tell us a little bit about the Tarot of the Nine Paths. It's a deck of 30 cards only, is that right?
Yeah. It's the major arcana. The deck is exclusive. I think of it as post-tarot, if you will, in that it is just a major arcana, but the whole deck was created based on my my thesis that the major arcana of the tarot over the last 600 years has been perfect in its own self, but unfinished. Short five cards, and if there's a way of looking at the infrastructure of the trump cards, the big cards of tarot, laying them out and deciphering a code of meaning in between the cards that really, I think, suggests that somehow the deck stopped on the third row, and five new cards really needed to emerge to create a symmetry of the body of information we call the major arcana of tarot. Those are the trump cards. So this deck is has moved the major arcana from 22 to 27 cards, added five, all correlated astrologically and kabbalistically and numerologically in ways that we're careful not to upset the existent tarot, because I'm very respectful of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of has brought it into the 21st century, and at least that's what I believe. And then there are three more cards in addition to the what I call the matrix of the Tarot of Nine Paths. One is a card which is called the Quaternity, which is the entire minor arcana in one card.
Mm-hmm.
And so pure tarotists will not will at first wince a little bit, because the minor arcana, which is the suit cards, you know, are important and beautiful tradition in the tarot. They're not in this deck, and there's a whole discussion as to why. Even though I've been teaching the tarot for 20 years or so, so I'm a big fan of the minor arcana ordinarily. But in this deck, TMP, it's just the majors, and then there's these two other cards, and the other card is called the Traveler, which is really a symbol of it's really who we are as kind of ordinary people with who are living in this postmodern world, trying to figure out how, you know, how we can deal with the historical reality of being in Europe or America or whatever, and being in our lives and our jobs and families, etc., and having a deep sense that there's also a spiritual strata or a spiritual mandate in our psyches to develop our consciousness. So that card, the Traveler, really symbolizes we as ordinary human beings about to step on the path of the Tarot of the Nine Paths.
Mm.
So that's what that deck is about.
Interesting.
Like I said, the cards were, it took me about a number of years, were each done in a sand play scene that was in kind of an abstract way, carried my sense of the meaning of that particular card.
Mm.
So that's what that is.
Interesting. What would you say, I mean, in regards to that, the time that we're living in, if we talk a little bit more about this Traveler, I think a lot of people listening to this program and so forth can kind of identify with that in regards to kind of seeking a spiritual path or trying to figure out kind of in a way where we're going. What do you consider to be some of the, this is a big question, of course, but some of the problems that we're facing right now, and how can we deal with them, or how do we better, I guess, in one sense, overcome these problems?
That's a great question. Where I would start with is the the conditioned mind and the way our thinking processes, our, you know, almost you could say our human neurosis, and the culture that it's created has conditioned reality with to look very much the way it does. We've kind of, whether we're born into this realm that's based on, you know, hatred, greed, and delusion, as the Buddha taught, the three poisons, and you know it rests on this kind of consumerist, capitalist, or alternative to capitalist kind of economic world, and the individual is a pretty new entity. I mean, I think that only in the last, I don't know, the modern period, maybe in the last several hundred years, has there been much time for an individual psyche to stop and make choices about how they want to live their lives, because there's been such a, you know, such a push in survival for, you know, in the whole human history.
Yeah, that's right.
So now it's very exciting in that we're, you know, we're both at a very dangerous and very exciting age in the history of the human experiment. And so it's particularly hot and alive for people like that listen to this show, who are now living in this at this time, and also have access to all of these great wisdom teachings and tools. So it's a very fascinating time that we're here.
Absolutely, and to me it feels, I totally agree with you. It feels like these last couple of hundred years, and at least from the perspective of the Western world, I personally really don't know how it is in other countries. I've heard Joseph Campbell, for instance, talk about the main, you know, differences about the Eastern mindset and the Western mindset, and that we here in the West have had this little piece of what we can see as a kind of a glimmer of freedom, at least, or individuality, where we can choose, you know, how we want to live our lives to a certain extent. Do you think that we're in a time right now where this also is being threatened in one regard? I can see that the freedom that we have been given is also, what I see now, taken away a little bit, and we're moving into a kind of a new feudalist system, if you know what I mean. What do you think?
Well, yes, certainly. It's, you know, I can definitely see that occurring, particularly from childhood and coming into certain cultures where their minds are so conditioned in such a heavy-handed way from such an early age that there's no possibility that they can grow up to be individuals. That's a problem. This past Christmas, I was in India, in New Delhi, teaching the tarot, actually. And what occurred to me, it was really phenomenal, because I had an all-day seminar and had, 60, 70 students who were very much similar to the types of students I might have in America or in Europe,
mm-hmm.
in terms of a kind of a young, professional, educated, bright, compassionate group of folk who were using the tarot cards, a Western thing, but they're Indian, and they had their own long-standing deep tradition in spirituality. And what occurred to me was how, in some ways, there's not that much difference at all, and that there is a universal quality that people all around the world are carrying right now and developing that is can't be turned back by bad government and bad culture. I think that it's just amazing how, you know, global, particularly with shows like this and the internet and the 21st century communications, how global consciousness has become.
Hmm. How about the idea that, or rather, are you concerned in one regard that maybe more local symbols, archetypes, gods and goddesses are being lost in all of this, or do they all kind of in one way represent the same forces anyway? So it doesn't really care, doesn't really matter which one we turn to, or what would you say to that?
Let me turn that question back on you for a moment and ask you, are there in particular certain types of sacred images that you feel are being threatened now in a way that concerns you?
Well, I'm asking the question because I can only see what has happened, I guess, here up in Sweden, for instance, where for a time it was even considered, you know, racist to identify with Thor or carrying a Thor's hammer around your neck, whatever. And if we look around in some of the major cities up here, we have statues of Greek gods and goddesses. We have Poseidon here in Gothenburg, for instance, at the main avenue or the main strip, as it were. And I'm wondering what the heck happened to all the indigenous original gods that we had up here. And I see that it's kind of a, in that sense, a monoculture that is spreading out throughout the world. And I guess, I don't know if that really is a concern, but I'm curious about it, and I wonder how that actually affects us.
Well, you know, that's really interesting, and I hear where you're coming from there, and that is interesting. You know, I think that the problem always is about identification and attachment to anything, and the thing about these archetypal energies is that they carry this collective mentality with them. I mean, we can look at some of the great, you know, disasters of human history, like, you know, the Holocaust and things like that, which emerged around certain archetypes that they became very strong in the collective consciousness. And, you know, a certain kind of mob mentality operates when you're tapping into an archetype on a societal level that in some way forces activates people to behave in ways that they wouldn't do individually.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there's a certain kind of mob mentality that could take place, and that's concerning.
Yeah.
But if you look at any one of those, and that's happening, you know, that happens all over the place in different forms. Certainly in the last U.S. elections with the left and the right, you know, we could see all kinds of permutations and energies emerging in different ways. And yeah, that's concerning. That's why, because when you deal with the depths and the archetypes of the psyche, which are deep parts of ourselves, are deeper than our learned knowledge we're born with, and they're activated. The archetypes are activated. That's why tools, I think, like the tarot, like the I Ching, perhaps, like some of these other time-tested universal symbol systems that are really based on the perennial philosophy, if you will,
mm-hmm.
are particularly valuable because we need kind of the wisdom. We need to be able to find human wisdom that's timeless during periods of history where we're being flooded by all of this kind of nationalistic or all these energies that are short-sighted.
Hmm. Do you think that these have been, how should I put it, important at that specific time to live through in order to, what I'm thinking of is certain interpretations of the Mayan calendar, for instance, about the different energies that we've been going through as a kind of a evolutionary cycle in regards to our psyche or our awareness, and that the nationalistic mindset has been important, but only for a certain amount of time. But in a way, now we've kind of stuck in that, if you know what I mean, and the importance, I guess, what you're saying is that we need to maybe move on from that in one sense, or am I on the right path? What do you think?
Right. Now, I think you're making important observations about what's going on in cultures, and I agree. What the solution is from my vantage point, it's not replacing bad gods with good gods.
Sure. Yeah.
Because it's still bad archetypes with good archetypes. It's more developing awareness and a level of consciousness to the now, you could say, or to the unconditioned, that can hold these archetypal energies differently, that are not at the effect of them, that are not being basically manipulated and dominated by these powerful energetic potentials that are in their deep subconscious, but rather are now out in, out on the table in front of them, and they still are able to maintain enough presence and self-awareness to work with the energy from a mindful, conscious way without losing oneself in a belief system.
Yeah.
That's the challenge.
Yeah. Very, very good point. And why don't we begin to run things up here for the first hour and talk a little bit more about the DVD that you're in as well, The Great Work. I want to mention a little bit about that, and then we can talk a little bit more about how people can get a copy of the Tower of the Nine Paths. Is that out yet, or is that going to be out later
summer? It's being printed as we speak, and it will be available by the end of the summer, though I am taking orders now, so if people over my website, so if people are interested, they can just contact me on that. It will be out and available, widely available, in late August or September.
Great. Mention your website again for people who want to go there and check it out.
It's artrosengarten.com, and Rosengarten is spelled with a T-E-N, like T as in tarot, Rosengarten. And that's how you'll see that I have a whole lot of things on my website with maybe 100 articles on various topics like we're discussing, images of the deck and information about my book, Tarot and Psychology and Synchronicity and other interesting things that I think your audience will find interesting.
Very good. And I also want to mention The Great Work, again, that for people who are interested in listening to this program, I talked with the producer, Venetia, and she's offered the Red Eyes audience a 25% discount. You can just, if you go into the website magicalegypt.com and type in ART, A-R-T, in the coupon code box, that's for Arthur Rosengarten, obviously, ART, in the coupon code box, you'll get a 25% discount. But head on over to the website magicalegypt.com and check out some of that, because there's trailers up there that people can take a look at in case they're interested. And this is some of the things that we've been talking about here in regards to the sandbox therapy and so forth that we've been discussing. So definitely take a look at that. But Art, let's begin here to round things up. Hour one, I definitely want to talk more about you after our break in our member section about the importance of the number nine. Maybe we can go into a little bit more about synchronicity, symbolism, and also, I guess, the importance of history and how kind of that goes together in regards to the unconditioned, in a way of how can we keep a memory, if you know what I mean, of history, and at the same time kind of moving to the new. It was learn from history, but yet move into the new. So that's some of the things I'd like to discuss with you. But stay with us, Art. Thank you very much for this first hour. We're going to take a little break here, and we will be right back. Thank you for listening. We will continue talking more with Art Rosengarten. We're going to discuss the importance of nine, the number, and what it represents. We're also going to talk about the shadow aspects of ourselves, the ego, history, the apocalypse, death wish, polarization, illusion, the unconscious mind, and more on the tarot. So don't miss this second segment upcoming with Art Rosengarten. Join us in our member section. Head on over to redeyescreations.com, click on members to tune in, or click on subscribe if you're currently not a member. Sign up, try it out for 3 months. You'll get full access to our website with much more radio, films, video interviews, and webcasts. We'll take a short break. Stay with us, and we'll be right back for our members.